This episode of the Sit Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. Are you into props? Do you like betting fantasy football? Are you ready for football? Thrive Fantasy has you covered. With Thrive, you can eliminate the countless hours of research and focus on only the top tier athletes that have the biggest impact on the game. Who the hell wants to worry about bench warmers and that kind of stuff? We can worry just about the top tier guys. And if you love props, this is definitely for you. What you do is you choose 10 out of the 20 available player props to build your lineup. Each prop is assigned a fantasy value for both the over and under based on how likely it is to hit. You hit the most props and you rack up the most points to win big shares of prize pools. Keep in mind, Thrive Fantasy has over 140,000 guaranteed in prizes for NFL Week 1. NFL Week 1 is coming. We're about a month away from the NFL season. And Thrive Fantasy wants to award you with over that and a ton of money as the season gets going. Thrive also features 100K guaranteed contests, and it's just $20 to enter, and first place takes home $20,000. I urge you, if you enjoy the Sit Down, if you enjoy football, go check out a brand new app, Thrive Fantasy, and if you use promo code SITDOWN when you sign up today, you're going to get 100% instant deposit as a bonus. Up to $100. So if you put up $100, they're going to give you $100 and you can play that for free on Thrive Fantasy. If you like player props, I love player props. It's the sport app for you. Don't do the general, just fantasy apps. Go check out Thrive today. Get in the game. Again, promo code sit down when you sign up today and you receive 100% instant first deposit match up to $100. Get involved. Thrive Fantasy. Football's coming.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime podcast. Hope you're all having a great day wherever you are. I am Jeff Nadeau, and as always, we got a big show for you today, another great show. Coming off the heels of, I think, our best show last week on Tony Salerno. This week, another heavy hitter. A Mount Rushmore type of guy, Carlo Gambino. We've heard the name, the Gambino crime family. The ascension of Carlo Gambino is truly fascinating, really from old world Sicily all the way to the top of really the American mob. You know, when Carlo was really in his heyday, it's when the mob truly ruled this country. They were in indiscriminate businesses. They were in legit businesses, all sorts of things. And Carlo ran the gamut really until his end. So we'll talk about him and really how everything went down before him and then after him. We'll also do a little Q&A and we'll do a little news as well. Blackjack Fletcher, our co-host, joins us. Blackjack, I thought last week's show was terrific. We've got so many great messages about it. How you doing this week? Another show, another week, another show.
I am shining like a diamond and rolling with the dice, brother. Fantastic as always. Tony Salerno was a great show, but as much as I love Tony Salerno and talking about him, if there was one guy that you asked me to encapsulate the entire 20th century mafia picture, it's Carlo Gambino. Carlo Gambino for me is the guy in terms of where he's from, what he accomplished, the fact that he served very little time in prison during his life and almost none later in life, the repercussions of his death and what that led to. Carlo Gambino is, you talk about a Mount Rushmore guy, he is the guy to me that really encapsulates the 20th century mafia picture in the United States.
Yeah, I think the shrewdest mobster in the history of Cosa Nostra, probably the smartest. I think... You know, just the way he kind of tiptoed around, allowed others to really kind of hang themselves. And, you know, really just was there to everything he did from, you know, his ability to not be detected by law enforcement, to really not going to prison, to amassing a huge wealth. You know, the fact that he was just a little old guy, but he was literally the most powerful individual, you know, really on the East Coast. So We're going to get into that. Just a fascinating show. We're going to obviously, again, as I said, do a Q&A. But a couple of questions here I got from the people. You know, we'll kind of do these if we get them and just kind of address them on the show. A couple here. Who is the most influential, successful mobster who never actually got made? Look, I think you were talking about just in general.
Yeah.
There's only two answers, Jimmy Burke and Meyer Lansky. As far as Italians, I mean, it's really something that you have to look really deep into. Most successful mobsters were made at some point. I think you really have to just look outside of the box and go to guys that, you know, obviously weren't Italian or, you know, half Italian or whatever. And I would lead right back to Jimmy Burke and Lansky. I think also Joe Watts, you throw him in there. He did a lot of stuff for the Gambinos, and it was obviously important to look. I know John Elite would say he wants to be mentioned in this group, though we're not going to mention A-Light here.
I mean, listen, I agree with you that Jimmy Burke is up there. To me, Meyer Lansky's the answer. I mean, Meyer Lansky, if you look at the influence that Meyer Lansky had, not only in the mob, because that to me is the difference in this question. Jimmy Burke's influence was mob related. Meyer Lansky's influence is still felt in America today. Las Vegas would not be Las Vegas without Meyer Lansky. He was a pivotal figure in turning Las Vegas into what we know it is today. Meyer Lansky's legacy to me extends beyond the mafia into just American culture. To me, he's the answer here.
Yeah, I mean, the mob's accountant. I mean, it's pretty simple. You know, he set up alliances and it just was huge. There is no other answer. Who do you think will take over the Philadelphia crime family if, God forbid, Joey Merlino passed away? Look, I'm not answering.
Not gonna happen.
Listen, he is very young, first of all. He's only in his 50s. And second of all, look, I don't have to tell you who that would be. I think we don't know, honestly. I mean, there are multiple people that are in that crew, in that group. Those guys are all friends. We talked about this before. All the guys that are supposed to be in leadership there are all friends with each other. They've been friends for years. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. You know, but if he dies, you know, everyone dies. Eventually he will die. I don't know who would take over, though. You know, again, I'm not going to get much into like current day stuff.
No, that's not what we're doing here.
I walk the streets down there. So I don't, you know, I don't want to piss anybody off.
Jeff wants to be able to get breakfast on Oregon Street.
Oregon Avenue.
Yeah, you want to be able to get breakfast.
Which, by the way, if I could just quickly say, so Oregon Express, really a throwback to, you know, when I go there, it's so terrific because it is truly a throwback to just the life you want to live. So I don't know if you've ever been to these kind of places, Blackjack, but the old Luncheonette is a lost.
Yep. America, dude, I could not agree more.
The diner, it's not a diner. It's not a corner store. It's a Luncheonette that's open from like 6 a.m. to like 1.
Yep.
Right? Yep. And their business is strictly eggs, egg sandwiches, French toast, things like that. Get a breakfast sandwich, an espresso, some donuts, whatever you want. They get all the stuff in every day. And whenever you go into this place, Bike Jake, it has got 6 or 7 guys that are about 300 pounds apiece, 400 pounds apiece. They're all sitting in there talking about the game. It's a lot. It's terrific. And it's literally right in the middle of South Philly. They've got great food. They do the bacon, egg, and cheese on a long roll. It's just stupendous. I love that place. It is a staple. And if you ever in Philadelphia, if you ever go for a Phillies game and stay over, or you're in Philly for some reason, go to Marvine Street and Argan Avenue. It's the best, truly. Next one. Where is Tony Bender Strollo? That's a good question. No one knows where Tony Strollo is. For anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about here, Anthony Strollo was a guy that really had been around since the turn of the century. In 1899, he was born. He was a very important part of the Luciano crime family and then eventually the Genovese crime family. He served really early years. He was big in Prohibition, big-time bootlegger, worked under Joe Masseria, kind of survived that whole thing, which we'll talk a little bit about today. He becomes close with Lucky Luciano. Then he goes into the Vito Genovese group. And down the road, this person's asking where he is. What happened was down the road, Carlo Gambino, which we'll talk about, he decides to conspire against Vito Genovese. He wants Vito Genovese out because he wants Fonzie Thierry to take over the family. And in the late 50s, Anthony Strollo, who is a trusted capo of Genovese, decides that he's going to join the conspiracy, and he has a secret meeting with Gambino. Eventually, Vito Genovese gets jammed up on a drug trafficking conviction and goes away. At that point, Genovese is furious and has Strollo basically killed. His body was never recovered, and he literally disappeared. According to Joe the Rat Valachi, he testified that, according to him, that Genovese in prison said that he was responsible for Strollo's murder. They called him Tony Bender. He was never found. He eventually went on a real bender and never came back.
Look at you.
So there you go. Nice little hit there. But he, interesting guy for sure. Obviously was around a lot of different groups. But in the end, deceit was the big thing. You don't go against Vito Genovese and expect to be standing.
No, I mean, listen, the obvious answer is Vito Genovese had him killed. I mean, where he is or where his body went, who the hell knows? But
dust
Vito Genovese had him killed.
Correct. What does the modern mafia look like now? We've answered this question before. It's definitely a lot more underground, a lot more white collar stuff, a lot of legitimate operations, you know, housing businesses, flipping houses, mechanic shops, legit businesses. And there's things going underneath it. There's still bookmaking. There's still loan sharking. You know, there's still drug dealing. It's all going on still. It's just a lot more underground. This is an interesting question. I've been waiting for someone to ask me about this. A buddy brought me Hollywood Godfather after hearing Johnny Russo on a show he listens to. I got started and felt like I was reading some good old fishing stories. And after some Google searches, I thought I might be. Is Johnny Russo telling tall tales, or is there some truth to his stories? So asking me if Johnny Russo is legitimate is like asking me if I think that aliens are going to knock on my door. Of course not. Johnny Russo, for anyone that doesn't know, was an actor. He played Carlo in The Godfather. And nowadays, he has moonlighted as a storyteller. He goes on these, you know, Vlad TVs and all these different platforms and just tells nonsense tales about how he had a life in the mob. And like, he's told some of the most ridiculous like stories you ever hear. Like, he claims that Pablo Escobar wanted him killed, and that when he was 15, he slept with Marilyn Monroe, and he robbed $86 million in 3 hours from six banks. Like, he killed a pedophile that tried to rape him when he was a kid. Like, all this crazy stuff. Like, not that he didn't do that. I don't know if he did that. He said he did when he was a kid, but just these wild, weird stories.
He's a weird cat, dude. He's a weird cat because, to me, Johnny Russo is a guy who, like you said, he's told a lot of tall tales, right? Like, shit that just doesn't add up. But he also has led, like, a really fascinating life. Like, you're talking about a guy who not only was in, you know, The Godfather, but also acted in movies like Super Mario Brothers, Any Given Sunday, and Seabiscuit. He defeated the federal government on 23 different indictments, okay? And he killed a guy by shooting him in the head inside a Las Vegas nightclub and got away with it. So, like, he's a guy who clearly has made up a lot of shit, right? But he's also a guy who's led kind of a fascinating life.
If it's true, I mean...
Well, the Vegas thing is true. I mean, the district attorney's office in Clark County ruled that it was a justified shooting because there was an altercation going on between two patrons, and Russo had a license to carry, pulls his gun out, shoots the guy in the head.
I guess there's some parts of the thing that he says like that are interesting. Like, he talked about when he was a kid, he had polio, and he talks about like how he was literally in quarantine for like 5 years. Like, you know, there are some interesting parts, and he like was an interesting actor and stuff. Yeah. But some of the stuff he says is like way out of
left. Crazy. It's crazy. I mean, like you said, like sleeping with Marilyn Monroe at 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, Marilyn Monroe's fucking around with a 15-year-old. She could have any guy she wanted. She's fucking around with a 15-year-old kid.
Right. I mean, outside of that, though, like, the story you told, obviously, I think's believable, but, like, most of the stuff he says is completely untrue. It's just not. It's not factual. He tells stories. He's an old man. I think you just laugh.
I think he's one of those guys who has just enough credibility to him that when he says something, people believe
him. Right. Exactly. Exactly. But, and he also kind of looks the part, but it's like, you know what? He doesn't really say anything. Like, he's talked about, like, he's like literally murdered people. Like, and he just kind of says, he's like Arab. He just says stuff out of nowhere. And I guess he doesn't think people are going to watch it. There's no statute of limitations on murder.
But that's the thing, right? It's like, because he did kill the guy in Vegas in the 80s.
Yeah.
It's like, if he turns around and says, oh, I also killed this guy. And someone's like, I don't know about that. He's like, well, ask the guy in Vegas.
He does have some legitimacy to him, so he can kind of like fall back on stuff, but it's like most of the stuff he says is unfounded.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into Carlo Gambino. Yeah. We've waited long enough. Let's delve into it. A wild story. Carlo Gambino. I call him the fox. I think he's very much like a fox. He's very.
I don't want to put pressure on us, Jeff, but this is, in my estimation, the biggest episode we've ever done.
Yeah, especially the character we're doing.
Yes.
Agreed. All right. Carlo Gambino was born August 24th, 1902 in Palermo, Sicilia. So this is kind of the first guy we've talked about that was actually born in Italy, right? We have dealt with many mob guys, but all of them were born in America. Now, Carlo was born to a family that was high end in Sicily. They all belonged to the Sicilian mafia at the time in that area. And he had two brothers, one of which was not in the mob. The other one was part eventually of the Gambino crime family. Keep in mind how kind of Sicily works and has worked for many years. There are parts of Sicily, particularly even in Palermo and where Carlo grew up, where the mafia literally runs everything. There are neighborhoods where the police don't go. Government does not interfere with. They own it. They run it. Everything is controlled by them. They were literally untouchable. And Carlo growing up really looked up to those people, especially ones that were in his family. Like any young guy, any young mobster, he sees the guys in the suits and the cars with the women, and they really lived the life that everyone respected. Over in Italy, mobsters at this time were royalty, really.
Yep.
And Carlo, I think, was always kind of destined for it. His family was part of it. He had obviously connections over in America with the Castellanos, who were very much big over there. So it was really in his lifeblood, Blackjack, to become someone that was in the mob. But in Italy, being in the mob is like being part of government.
It is. He was, as you mentioned, Sicilian, which especially at this point in time was a major, major stronghold for the Italian mafia, right? Sicily was where a lot of this was based. We've talked on this show before. My mother's family is Italian. They are Neapolitan. They're from Naples. And people in mainland Italy have something of a distrust of Sicilians. And I think a lot of that stems from the fact that the mafia had such strong control over Sicily, over that island. You know, the famous saying, Jeff, I know you've heard it, is the serpent lies in Sicily.
Right.
You know, they viewed Sicilians as kind of underhanded, sneaky people.
Yeah, no, and you're totally right. You know, in Italy, there's kind of that region war where, you know, Northerners don't like Southerners and Southerners don't like Sicilians. There's all sorts of kind of interregional things that go on, but Gambino was kind of destined for mob royalty. And growing up, his mentor was a guy called Don Vito Cacciaferro. Cacciaferro was really kind of the chieftain of that area. He ruled the Sicilian mafia. He was a high up. He did a lot. He had a lot of connections over in America. And he, according to historians, really was the main creator of the extortion racket, the modern day extortion. At the time, extortion in Sicily was this ridiculous demand for money that people just couldn't pay, and they were pillaging businesses. He kind of said, you know what? we're only going to charge a few dollars and we're going to just take from everyone. We're going to make people happy. We're going to make them prosperous. And they're going to look at us as like heroes, right? And we're going to kind of have our control over them and we're going to help them as well. And he looked at that as, while it was extortion, he was also doing a service to the community. He was truly doing protection rackets for the entire area. And Carlo kind of grew up kind of behind him and saw him kind of doing this. He once had a quote that you have to skim the cream off the milk without breaking the bottle, and that we don't throw people into bankruptcy with ridiculous demands for money. We offer them protection instead and help them make their business prosperous. And not only will they be happy to pay out, but they'll kiss our hands out of gratitude. So we really looked at the mob as a needed thing in that area. And it did, because a lot of those folks lived in poverty. The mob was really there for them when no one else was. So he was the first real creator of our typical modern day extortion.
That's a great distinction too, because when you talk about extortion, generally when you talk about extortion nowadays, it involves a threat of some kind. And what this to me is, this is the distinction between extortion and the protection racket, because it's not easy for a lot of people nowadays to understand this in the society that we live in. But even, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, in a place like New York City where crime was running rampant, you know, you would have a small business and you are dependent on every dollar coming in. And if people are coming in and vandalizing your store or robbing your store, maybe that means now you can't make your rent payments. Maybe that means you can't pay your employees. You know, you can't afford to put food on the table. So the idea that we will protect your livelihood for a small amount of money, amount of money that's not going to break you, is really a smart thing, right? Because it ensures continuing business and it ensures gratitude, which is what you want in this line of work, right? Like, you don't want people who are looking for a way to get rid of you. You want them to want you around.
And I think when you look at Gambino, a lot of his stuff that he would do later in life was really just shrewd and smart, but it was also almost kind of a portrayal of what this guy did. Luigi Barzini, who is a journalist in Italy, once said about Don Vito Cacciaferro, "Don Vito brought the organization to its highest perfection without undue recourse to violence. The leader who scatters corpses all over the island in order to achieve his goal is considered as inept as the statesman who had to wage aggressive wars. Don Vito ruled and inspired fear mainly by the use of his great qualities and natural ascendancy. His awe-inspiring appearance helped him. His manners were princely, his demeanor humble but majestic. He was loved by all, being very generous, but he never refused a request for aid and dispensed millions in loans, gifts, and general philanthropy." So again, we saw this with Al Capone, who did this. He took care of his people. Was this guy a gangster? Yeah, but in Italy, they looked at this guy as royalty, and he was truly the true government to a lot of these people. And that's the kind of guy that Don Carlo Gambino really came up under.
I think you can draw parallels in many places, right? Like, we've talked on this show about guys who were overly greedy and it was their downfall. We've talked about guys that were overly violent and that was their downfall. Then even in modern times, right? You look at a guy like John Gotti, who certainly had his issues. But if you ask the people in Howard Beach, Queens, what they thought of John Gotti, they loved him. They said he was a prince. They said he was the most generous guy around. If I needed something, I went to John. John took care of me. And I think that probably comes from Carlo Gambino.
He once said, "Look around. Everybody loves us."
True.
And that was true. And that was true with him. That was true with Don Vito Cacciaferro. That was due with Carlo Gambino. In high school, as a teenager, Carlo would drop out and become an enforcer. Keep in mind, there was a little need for an enforcer in this time in Sicily. Carlo was only 5'7". He was a small build kind of guy, but he had a hawk beak nose. He was shy and, according to people, deadly. So he wasn't a guy that I think really was, he wasn't huge or you know, full of muscles or anything, but he was an imposing figure, if you will. Carlo was obviously, like I said, incredibly smart and shrewd. And at 19, he would be made into the Sicilian Mafia. He really ascended quickly, and that had a lot to do with some of the connections that he had through his family. In the early 20s, though, the Sicilian Mafia would encounter a problem, and the Italian Mafia in general would encounter a problem. Benito Mussolini would be kind of ascending to the top of Italian, kind of take over as fascist governor. And he would really wage a war against the mafia and truly work to end the mafia. And at the time, Sicilian mob guys basically just said, look, we got to get out of here. If we have connections overseas, we gotta go. And Carlo had a ton of connections. His family, the Castellanos, were a high-end group in America, and they were killing it in bootlegging. Obviously, with the Volstead Act, bootlegging was gigantic. In 1921, at the end of 1921, Carlo Gambino would set sail and go to America. He would enter the United States on December 23rd at Norfolk, Virginia, and he would be stowed away in a vessel that was bringing provisions from Italy to New York. He was the only individual on board outside of the crew on the SS Vincenzo Florio. And that's when he would make his way into the United States. He would set up in Brooklyn and start working for his family, the Castellanos, who had a trucking company. Now, the trucking company was run by his uncle's family, and pretty much it was a front for rum running. They were a large bootlegging organization, and the trucking company was a great front for that. Carlo would go to work and kind of deal with the routes, and he would deal with, obviously, people trying to hijack trucks and things of that nature. If you've ever seen Boardwalk Empire, a lot of the stuff that went on in the early seasons of that, Carlo was very much involved with. He would live right on the Brooklyn waterfront. And look, again, the Castellanos were thriving. Bootlegging was free fucking money. It's that simple, Blackjack.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about bootlegging multiple times on this show before. I mean, people weren't giving up their alcohol. All the Volstead Act did was increase demand for it, and somebody was going to supply it. And yeah, as you said, free money is, I mean, it's probably an understatement. I mean, these guys are making money hand over fist.
When he came to the United States, Carlo would obviously do that, but he would also start working with a guy called Joe Masseria. They would call him the boss, and he worked for a criminal organization that Masseria pretty much owned. And, you know, Joe the boss obviously was someone that I think Carlo kind of connected with. He had kind of the cunning style as well, and they were both shrewd. They both saw the bigger picture. But in the 1930s, Joe the boss Masseria would wage war against a rival, Salvatore Maranzano. And this is where Lucky Luciano becomes a legend. And as we know, Lucky and Carlo were close. Lucky kind of says to Carlo, look, we need to get the old mustache Pete's the hell out of here. We can wage war and basically let them kill each other. We then take over. The old world mafia needs to continue. And these old guys need to get out of the fucking way and let us handle things. So Carlo kind of sits back in the shadows and lets kind of things play out. And, you know, Lucky was pretty smart, obviously, at the end of the day. On April 15th, 1931, Joe the boss Masseria would be approached by four gunmen and killed in a cafe. And Salvatore Maranzano would take over and really kind of just believe that he was the capo di tutti capi, if you will. And he would also really just take control of everything. And he thought deep down that Luciano was okay with everything and everything was fine, and he was the top dog. By September of 1931, Maranzano would realize, though, that Lucky Luciano was kind of playing him, if you will. He would hire Mad Dog Colley to kill Lucky Luciano. Luciano figures it out, though, and makes his way through it. He would then eventually figure out Maranzano and send what he thought were agents to Maranzano's club. Maranzano lets them in. They then kill him. So Lucky Luciano orchestrates not only Masseria, but Maranzano. He then becomes the boss of all bosses. This is where he institutes the commission, which is a governing body for organized crime. And what this was for Carlo Gambino, gigantic, because he was a connector to Luciano. He would continue to use his stock and rise his stock. But Lucky Luciano did what he had to do. And we'll get to him down the road and kind of his life. But just a shrewd move by Gambino to just kind of sit back, let things play out, and the young guys had taken over.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, Gambino's a kid at this point still, right? I mean, he's off the boat less than 10 years. He's in a new country with new people and a new operation. And, man, he did the right thing by hitching his wagon to Lucky Luciano's star, because Luciano could see this coming. He knew what the moves were, and he orchestrated them perfectly. And as you alluded to, it set up Carlo Gambino much later in life to have a lot of control.
Yeah, and once Masseria was out of the way and that all went down, the family would, you know, become the Gambinos down the road. But it was first the Mangano crime family. It was headed by a guy called Vincent Mangano. Carlo and his cousins would become soldiers in that group. And they would really start to learn all the rackets. Carlo obviously knew a lot about old world Italian rackets and bootlegging, but he got to know bookmaking and loan sharking and all the normal rackets that one learns in the mafia. And this is also where he would connect his own cousin, Paul Castellano, who we talked about, into the family as well. And this is where he really strengthens his own family as well. In 1932, Carlo Gambino would marry his first cousin, Catherine Castellano, yes, who was Paul's sister. And Carlo was truly a shrewd guy, even down to his wife. He realized that he needed to get blood ties to not only the fact that it was his cousins, he wanted marriage as well. And look, down the road, Catherine Castellano, from what I understand, was a terrific woman. She was always very loyal, and she had a really set up a nice life for Carlo and his family. It was definitely weird, but in Italian culture, I've heard before, cousins marry cousins.
You know, I'm not going to defend cousin marrying. Rudy Giuliani did it, as we mentioned in another episode. Italian married his cousin, but I will give Carlo a little bit of a pass because cousins weren't even from the same country. I mean, you're living on different continents. Right. So I'll give him a little bit of a pass. It's not like they were hanging out together as kids.
Right.
So
right. That's true.
I will give Carlo a little bit of a pass here in that, yes, technically they are first cousins, but it's not like you think of your first cousin as, you know, somebody you were, you know, playing on the seesaw with when you were six. It wasn't that case.
Right. They were from different countries, as you said. The Castellano or the Gambinos would have four kids, Thomas, Joseph, Carlo, and Phyllis. In 1937, Carlo Gambino would do his only stretch ever in prison. By this point, bootlegging and prohibition were gone. Legal alcohol was back. But Carlo Gambino realized that he could make a huge amount of money doing contraband alcohol. And he sets up these distilleries and was selling illegal alcohol still, just making way more money out of it. He had a huge operation in Philadelphia. The feds busted it. He gets arrested for tax evasion. He ends up, though, really kind of not doing much time. He only ended up serving 22 months at Lewisburg. And in Carlo's 74-year life, he only went to prison for about 22 months. And those are 22 months. So it really wasn't much of anything.
At 35 years old, he did 22 months and he never did another day again.
Yeah, it's pretty
it's a hell of a run there, first of all. And second of all, isn't it kind of astounding, Jeff, that we don't have bootleg alcohol today?
Yes.
Think about the amount of tax that we pay on alcohol.
Correct.
Especially in some states, like in the Northeast and out in California. Like, why is nobody selling bootleg?
Well, there you go. A new business opportunity.
I mean, I would buy it. I'd save a ton of money.
Maybe I should start getting into that.
Let's get some bathtub gin.
Moonshine. During the mid-1940s, obviously, as we know, World War II was in full effect, and we had ration problems in this country. People were rationing everything, and the government had what they call ration stamps. Carlo Gambino would make huge amounts of money stealing and hoarding rationing stamps, and this is where really his first major fortune was made. Keep in mind, Carlo is still just kind of coming up in the crew. He's not a boss at this point. He's still earning for the family. He's doing what he has to do, but he's proving himself to be a huge earner. Carlo was also very involved in the nightclub industry. In fact, he was very involved in owning gay nightclubs. According to people, Carlo realized that in that time, in the 40s and 50s, the gay men in New York were doctors. They were lawyers. They were very uppity people. Carlo would also said to be, at one point, use some of those folks to blackmail. They had secrets. Carlo knew them. And he aligned that with powerful people and made it bad, I think, for some. But really, a jack of all trades, did literally pretty much everything to make money. In 1951, though, the family would start to kind of unravel. Philip Mangano, who was Vincent Mangano's brother, is found dead in Brooklyn in 1951. And also down the road, just a few days later, Vincent Mangano would disappear. And he was never found and was declared dead 10 days later. So kind of an interesting story was setting up where no one really was ever arrested for those murders. But down the road, 10 years later, he was pronounced dead. This was really an order of people were starting to take control. Albert Anastasia was starting to take control. He wanted to be boss. Mangano had to go. Albert Anastasia was now the new boss of the Mangano crime family. Now, during all this that's going on, once this all finishes up, Vito Genovese, who is part of the Genovese crime family, running the Genovese crime family, Frank Costello takes over the family when Vito goes away for some period of time. Genovese decides that he wants to remove Costello, and he, as we know, does that through Chin Gigante, or tries to do that through Chin Gigante. As that's happening, his counterpart and his the guy that he kind of trusts in a way, Carlo Gambino, decides he's also going to eventually move on his boss. Carlo realized he may not outlive Anastasia, and it would truly be for him a similar situation that would arise down the road for Mr. Neil Della Croce, who was very old world, but wasn't willing to kill anyone to get the boss title. Albert Anastasia was also out of control. A lot of people will talk about some of the issues he had as a boss, but Carlo says, you know what, this guy, I'm getting him out of the way. I'm going to do what I have to do. And all of a sudden they're kind of setting up a power grab, kind of like Lucky Luciano did back in the day. So Genovese tries to take her to Costello. Costello gets the picture and leaves the situation, making him the boss of the Genovese family. And eventually, as we know, in 1957, Albert Anastasia is killed at the Park Sheraton Hotel. Now, I want to quickly talk, because when we did the Persico episode, a lot of people that study the mob believe that the hit was done by Crazy Joe Gallo and Persico and Gallo's brothers. There's an interesting theory that Carlo Gambino actually appointed his eventual underboss was a guy, Joe Biondo. It's talked about that Joe Biondo was actually the one that was farmed out with handling the hit, and that his brother handled the hit. Actually, when you go back and read some of the particulars about the case, witnesses would say that the three gunmen that killed Anastasia were, one of them was, quote, stocky. They all looked like they were in their 40s or older and were Italian. I think you can kind of rule Persico and Gallo out because they were not that old.
Correct.
Now, again, the witnesses may have just seen the wrong people or whatever, or just misquoted what they saw. But I still think there's a lot of question on who actually killed Albert Anastasia. And I know there's a channel on YouTube I really like called OC Shorts. He's a great mob historian. He kind of talks about this stuff. He has a theory about the Biondos and how he thinks they were the ones that killed Albert Anastasia. It makes sense. You'd have to figure Carlo's not going to farm the hit out to Joe Profaci. He's going to have people in his own family take care of Anastasia.
Because if you're going to take out a boss in your own family, you're going to keep it in-house. Yeah, I don't think you go outside for that under any circumstance. But it's a shrewd move by Gambino here, because as you said, he may not outlive Anastasia. They were born in the same year. They're both born 1902, right? So, I mean, they're the same age. Anastasia's getting a little out of control. And now you've got this all of a sudden, this natural partnership, right? Because Vito Genovese wants to move against Costello. Costello is close with Anastasia. You can get both of them out, take two seats on the commission, and now all of a sudden, you've got a different power structure here. It was, if you're going to make this move, it's the right time to make it.
Yeah, so there were two new bosses, Vito Genovese and Carlo
Gambino. Who are now aligned.
Right. Carlo would become the boss and change the name of the family to the Gambino crime family, a true power move. Obviously, after the Anastasia hit, almost immediately the Apalachin meeting was set. Yep. And Vito Genovese really wanted to show everybody he was the new big, bad, powerful boss of all bosses, and sets up this meeting up in New York, as we know. It was said that Carlo Gambino was likely there. And again, things start to get interesting because down the road, Vito Genovese and Carlo Gambino's relationship would very much kind of hit the skids at some point. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit. But, and we actually talked about that with the Strollo stuff. But Apalachin was – we'll have to do a show on that and kind of the
100%.
You know, what exactly happened and what went on. But the police would kind of let certain people go, and it was always kind of interesting how that all went down. Obviously, as I said, eventually in the late 50s, Vito Genovese, Carlo Gambino kind of sours on him and Luciano, old friends. Obviously, his relationship with Luciano was a lot more important than the Genovese connection. He takes part and pays this Puerto Rican drug dealer to implicate Genovese in a drug deal. They pay him a ton of money to do it. Eventually, Genovese gets 15 years for heroin trafficking, and he eventually died. And this is where Gambino truly takes over the entire Borgata. He takes over and becomes controller of the commission, the capo di tutti capi. Everything was his, and he had finally gotten to the king of the volcano. He was the guy now. Everybody was out of the way. He was the guy. And what we've learned about some of these old school guys, Salerno, Tony Ducks Corallo, Carlo Gambino, Paul Castellano, all these guys, what they learned quickly, though, as well, is drugs are no good. We're not selling drugs. We can make a ton of money without selling drugs. We don't need to sell drugs. And by this point, Carlo Gambino literally is controlling every racket, legitimate, illegitimate, everything. By this point, truck hijacking is becoming important. We'll talk about how he connects to that. Everything that's going on, everything that's done, New York is controlled by Carlo Gambino. And at this point in the 60s, the Gambino family was said that they had over 500 soldiers, 1,000 associates, and 25 different groups in the family in different parts of the city. Yeah. It was truly the biggest mafia organization in America.
I mean, you've alluded to this on previous episodes about certain guys. This truly was a Fortune 500 company. I mean, this they didn't operate within the bounds of the law, but in every other aspect, this was a Fortune 500 company, from the guy at the top being the CEO to the middle management to the structure and everyone else down below. This was an enterprise the likes of which organized crime had not seen before and probably has not seen since.
Carlo was always scheming too. In 1962, his oldest son, Thomas, was looking for a wife. And she ends up, in typical Carlo fashion, marrying the daughter of Tommy Lucchese, who was in control of the Lucchese crime family. Carlo would realize that truck hijacking was incredibly important and that they needed to control the airports. So Carlo aligns his son with his daughter, and they have a holy union, the Gambinos and the Lucchese's. Truly, it's like Richie Aprile and Janis Soprano. It was said that over 1,000 guests would attend the wedding, and Carlo would present Lucchese with a $30,000 gift. Keep in mind, this is in the 60s. Lucchese would in turn give him parts of rackets at present-day JFK Airport. And look, Carlo would take over yet another big-time industry. He was always making inroads. He was always making deals, and nothing was off limits. If he had to marry his first cousin, he would. If he had to get his son to marry the daughter of a Lucchese boss, he would do it. He was truly always making deals. He was one of the shrewdest, smartest people you'll find. Interesting thing about Carlo, too, is while he was extremely wealthy, extremely powerful, he was a modest guy. If you've ever seen his home, very modest home in Brooklyn, everything he did was in secret. If you saw him walking down the street, he looked like Geppetto from Pinocchio. He was an old guy. You would never think anything different. He had a strong Italian accent. He was a little old Italian guy. He never spoke. He always talked in code. He was very low profile. Everything about Carlo was unsuspecting. Nobody knew anything. And people thought he was a nice guy. He was very polite, according to most people. I saw an interview with a woman one time that met him at a dinner theater. And she talked about how He was just a kind, nice, good-hearted guy. No one would ever think that that guy was running such a powerful organization. Now, there's an interesting story, Blackjack. There was one thing, though, Carlo had to do. This was his one vanity piece. And I don't know if you know about this story. Carlo had an unsuspecting house. He didn't have crazy suits. He didn't have multiple women. He didn't have big cars. He had one car. And the one thing he splurged on was a license plate that said CG1. That was his one thing that he had to have. He needed people to know that was his car. It was Carlo G's car.
I like that. I like that. Listen, I'm not above that. I've got a front license plate that says Blackjack on it.
So do you really?
I sure do.
Wow, that's lame.
That's really fuck yourself. Lame. That's lame.
It's like having like top dog on your license plate. It's like, I'm the top dog.
No, I'm Blackjack. That's me.
Yeah, I know. I get it. You're kind of like Carlo Gambino. There you go.
Goddamn right I am.
Pretty interesting. There was also some interesting quirks about Carlo Gambino. Obviously, we could agree. Have you ever heard him talk? I haven't.
No,
like he was literally unsuspecting. Like,
would not know the man's voice.
Yeah, he was never off the wall. He was cool. He was calm, as collected. It was said, though, that Carlo loved coffee to the point that he would drink up to 12 cups of coffee a day, which is crazy. I drink two when it's over.
But brother, he's an Italian, and I don't mean an Italian in the way Americans mean an Italian. You go over to Italy, they drink coffee all the time.
Yeah, but wouldn't he behave like Nicky Scarfo? I feel like he'd be all over the way, bouncing. Yeah,
one of those things, it's tolerance, right? Like you see some people who they have two drinks and, you know, they're getting goofy. And you see some guys who can have seven or eight drinks and you wouldn't know they had one. It's tolerance. The more you drink it, the easier it gets on you.
Yeah, trust pretty me, nuts. I will say, like, I drink coffee and, like, you know, I only drink a couple cups, but it doesn't, like, I don't ever get any issue with it. So, you know, maybe you just had a tolerance. That's right. It's better than alcohol. Could have been worse. By 1970, Carlo was on the top of the volcano, as we said, but he would be indicted in 1970 on charges of conspiring to hijack an armored car carrying $3 million. And this would obviously connect back to John Gotti and some of the Bergen crew, and they were involved. A lot of that was going on through them at the Idlewild Airport. He would be released on bail, but he was never brought to trial because of his poor health. They also, down the road, would look to deport Carlo Gambino, but it never worked because A, he had a massive heart attack, and B, it was said that Carlo had two congressmen on the payroll that he told he would pay for life if they were able to get him through this kind of stuff. So again, political connections ruled the roost. And if you had some connections, you could make things work. And that was never totally proven, but Carlo was able to shake his way out of that. He would evade prosecution. But the problem was his heart was weakening. His health was weakening. And, you know, I think he kind of had to realize that by his late 60s. Now, we've talked kind of about his shrewd ability to kind of do things behind the scenes. And there's a lot of things that have never truly really much been talked about, but there's a lot of questions on, was Carlo Gambino involved in more things than we think he was? It's also been talked about that Joe Colombo's death may have been from Carlo Gambino. A lot of people believe that Carlo was absolutely sick of Colombo, his behavior, his Italian-American Civil Rights League, all that kind of stuff. And according to reports, the guy that killed Gallo was actually seen at a club Gambino owned at one point, and it theorized that maybe Carlo would engage and create the funeral. It was never the death and then, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was never truly proven. It's kind of fascinating to think about, though.
It is. I mean, it certainly is. I mean, I could see a guy like Carlo Gambino getting real frustrated with Colombo. I mean, that the Italian American stuff that he was pulling was publicity stunt after publicity stunt. I could see it rubbing Gambino the wrong way.
And you kind of could expect Carlo, he was the ruler of everyone. He had to kind of put people in their place and, you know, kind of deal with that kind of stuff. We don't need that depth of attention.
Agreed.
In 1962, Lucky Luciano would die of a heart attack at Naples International Airport, and they would have a huge funeral, obviously. And not a lot of people know this, but Carlo Gambino would actually give the eulogy to that funeral, to that longtime friend of his. That would have been interesting to hear. Too bad they didn't get that on tape. I don't know.
Class move by Carlo Gambino, unlike his fat fuck cousin, Paul Castellano, brother-in-law, who didn't even show up to Neil Della Croce's funeral.
Yeah, true scumbag move there. Obviously, Castellano was, I think, an underrated boss. I think a lot of people think he sucked, but he wasn't that bad. Towards the end, he was bad, but
I just think he was a douchebag.
Like, he definitely couldn't.
The boss, he was okay, but I think as a guy, he was a douchebag.
Yeah, he definitely couldn't hold a candle to his cousin, for sure. Also, after Vito Genovese dies in 1969, the new official boss of the Genoveses is a guy called Gerardo Catena, but he would go to jail in 1970, and Tommy Eboli becomes the boss of the family front boss. The problem was he was too interested in selling drugs. He would borrow money from Carlo Gambino. It was said to be up to $4 million, and he just doesn't pay it back. And Carlo just says, you know what, fuck this guy. He's got a gun. We don't really want him as the boss anyway, because I want to put my guy, Fonzie Thierry, in control. And that's what Carlo did. He truly wanted everyone, every family, to be controlled by him, have connections to him, and he could play them like puppets. It was truly fascinating to watch. In 1972, Tommy Eboli would leave his girlfriend's apartment. And as he sat in a parked car, he was shot 5 times in the head and neck and died instantly. No one would ever be charged. So another kind of rival shitbag that didn't pay his debts had to die. And now he could put Fonzie Thierry as the new boss. Everything was working out good for Carlo Gambino. Truly was a unbelievable boss. Took and did what he had to do and was rich. He was powerful and truly controlled everything by this point.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think you've talked about it a few times on this show. One of the secrets to his success is that the guy consolidated power at every turn, right? I mean, he eliminated the risk of enemies, whether it's by marrying a cousin and now getting him at the Castellano family, by pairing his son off with the Lucchese's. You know, he consolidated power to the point where he becomes almost this mythical figure. And then his personality and the type of boss he was not the kind of guy that engendered jealousy or greed or ill will. I think he was just a very well-respected man.
Yeah, he was. And look, we can also talk about how much money he also would make in the garment district and the different unions. And just, there was just so much money coming in. He truly made the commission run like a well-oiled machine. And they literally ran New York in the 60s, the 70s. It was truly incredible. And again, really from the beginning, you know, once he came to America and aligned with Lucky Luciano, he would literally just sit back and let everything kind of play itself out and just kind of slither his way in to become the next big thing. And he was always making deals. He was always figuring out ways to strengthen his cause. By 1976, Carlo Gambino, those health problems would become worse and worse. And his heart was becoming very weak. On October 15, 1976, in the early morning hours, Carlo Gambino would die at his home in Massapequa, Long Island. The night before, he watched the New York Yankees clinch the AL pennant. And the official cause was natural causes. And no one really was surprised. Carlo had heart disease, had some problems. And, you know, it was going to happen sooner or later. Obviously, on his deathbed, he would make his cousin, Paul Castellano, the next boss. And we talked about that. They would have a funeral, a wake, all the stuff that Catholics do, which was definitely interesting due to the fact that the Catholic Church seems to pick and choose who can have funerals and who can't. Hundreds of people would show up to the funeral, including police. It was said that the procession consisted of 13 limos, a dozen private cars, and one large flower car. Obviously, this would all set up the Castellano stuff, and we all know what happened down the road. This is where, though, the Gambino family starts to take a turn. Castellano would prove to be ineffective and a total hypocrite. Gotti would rule and do some good things, but eventually really hurt himself. And when you look at the difference between Gotti and Gambino, the main difference was Gambino was the true essence of what you need to be in the mob. Quiet, silent, powerful, but also deadly, and not just fucking prate around and, you know, pretend you can do everything and you can stick John your middle finger up at the
peacock. You know, John Gotti was a peacock, right? He liked to strut and he liked to show off, and that's not Carlo. And listen, I'm not going to knock Carlo for tapping Castellano to succeed him, because number one, at the time, Neil Della Croce was in prison. Okay. So that's one factor. The other factor is, if we've talked about anything in this episode, it's that Carlo Gambino's philosophy was to consolidate power, keep it within the family, not just within the family in terms of the Gambino crime family, but the actual family. I don't blame him for tapping Castellano. Do I think Neil Della Croce deserved it? Yes, I do. But my beef is more with the way Castellano handled it after that than Carlo tapping him to begin with.
Yeah, he was truly incredible. I mean, really, from the beginning, I mean, he took what he wanted. He got it. You know, he got rid of the guy that was in front of him, realized that he wasn't ever going to be boss if he didn't do that, did it, became the boss, really took the – I mean, he was
– By the way, the guy that he took out was a legend in his own right.
Sure, sure. But he was a loose cannon, and Carlo really kind of centered the family. And look, you look at when he takes over. He takes over in 1957, dies in 76. So he was a boss for nearly 20 years. And in those 20 years, you could make the case that the mob was at its strongest.
I don't think you can make the case. I think it's impossible sure. to make any other case than the Cosa Nostra in the United States was at its most profitable and successful and thriving more than it ever has during that 19-year period.
Listen, the truth of the matter also is we can complain that he picked his cousin over, you know, Neil. But let's remember, up until this point, Paul Castellano did everything he needed to do. I mean, he was
yes,
like, and again, if you know anything about Gambino, he married his own cousin to strengthen his mob kind of lure and his ability. Like, he was never going to pick. He was big on blood ties. He was never going to pick someone that wasn't his blood to someone that was. It wasn't going to happen. Now, no. Wouldn't Neil have been a better boss?
Maybe.
Probably. I mean, but I still don't know that, you know, John Gotti would have still become the boss. I don't know if Paul would, you know, Paul would have eventually, though. I don't know. Maybe.
I go back to my whole philosophy on this is my line of thinking is that Paul Castellano's biggest mistake he made as boss was essentially splitting the family by keeping Neil Della Croce as underboss and handing him the rackets, you know, the gambling rackets, the loan sharking rackets, the extortion rackets, and Paul keeping the white collar stuff, you essentially created two families. What I think Paul should have done is he should have, Tommy Bilotti was his guy. He should have made Tommy Bilotti the underboss, given him control of the street to solidify his power, the way I think Carlo would have done. And then putting Mr. Neil in a role of consigliere where everybody can respect him. His voice is still going to be heard. It doesn't feel like he's being shortchanged. But for, you know, Mr. Neil was an old guy. Like, for somebody in his age, the role of consigliere feels appropriate.
Say what you want. Neil missed an opportunity. He was not willing to kill. And that's fair. I mean, he played by the rules. But, I mean, even Carlo Gambino didn't play by the rules. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think Neil could have taken Carlo out, but he didn't. I mean, he could have, right?
No, I mean, he could have, but I don't think that was ever in.
It wasn't in the car.
You know anything about Neil Della Croce? Neil Della Croce was a stickler for the rules. And
sure, but he was never going to. I mean, he was never
against Carlo Gambino.
Right. And I think maybe he just accepted that at some point. But truly, I think outside of Accardo, he's the perfect gangster. I mean, the only issue on his thing was the 22 months. Accardo didn't do any, but Carlo is surely Mount Rushmore. If he's not, you're a fucking idiot.
You talk about Mount Rushmore. If we were playing a fucking game of Jeopardy and the clue was his nickname is the King of the Volcano, it's Carlo Gambino.
Sure. Sure. I put Accardo just slightly above him just because he didn't ever go to prison. The 2 years Carlo did, you know, that's a little not. It's like The Wire and Sopranos.
I hear you. I put him a notch below him just because I think the effect that Carlo Gambino had on American Cosa Nostra is it's impossible to define. There is no American Cosa Nostra the way we know it without Carlo Gambino.
Yeah, he literally ran the country, you know. He literally ran the Eastern Seaboard. If you don't think Carlo isn't there, I don't think you know what you're talking about. Truly a visionary, truly a shrewd fox, truly a legend. And really kind of a life that just kind of figured itself all out.
Yep.
Carlo never really had any issue ever.
No,
you know, just one little thing when he was a young man due to, illegal alcohol that he was selling. But outside of that, I mean, he died a very rich man. He died at home and he watched the AL pennant and the Yankees won. He then died. It was pretty perfect for him. Probably.
That's not the worst way to go out.
No, not at all. And he had a long legacy. I mean, the Gambino family, the Gambino group, like there's still Gambinos running around, man. It's fascinating. Sure. By the way, one thing I loved about even Gambino, remember the film about Gotti, the guy that played Gambino? Like, didn't he remind you kind of him?
Of course he did. Of course.
I mean, he didn't have like the Italian accent, but it's like.
No, but he looked like Carlo Gambino.
Yeah.
The casting in that movie is off the charts.
It really is. It really,
whoever
really
did the casting for that movie deserves a fucking Oscar.
Agreed. So there you go. That's the show for this week. Carlo Gambino, succinct, very easy. You love talking about him. He's truly a legend. Maybe next week we'll do Lucky. I don't know. I just kind of decide who we're going to do and then we do them. So a great show, Blackjack. We're starting to do these a little bit later and I feel like the info is just a lot quicker and fresher.
Well, one of my favorite shows. I could talk about Carlo Gambino all night. He's truly a legend in American history. I mean, you say what you want. You call him a criminal, it's fine. He operated outside the bounds of the law. But he is truly a quintessential figure in American history.
He's mob royalty until the end. He was mob royalty in his entire life. From his early childhood, he was born into a mafia family. And he goes over and it really goes from being – royalty there to royalty here.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible. Yeah. Carlo Gambino on the sit down. Next week, we'll be back with yet another episode. As always, we appreciate you all tuning in. I got a number today, Blackjack. We're way over 200,000 listens at this point on the show. Next week will be our 20th episode and it'll wrap up season one of the sit down. So excited for that. Lot of folks still to do. I urge you, as always, to follow us on Twitter at the sit down seven. Also make sure you, if you subscribe to the show, make sure you give us a review, let us know what you think, give us 5 stars. We greatly appreciate it. It helps out our algorithm and it helps out the show. So make sure you check out everything we have going on. And again, if you ever have a question, make sure you reach out, make sure you comment, make sure you let us know what you think. I'm the big man on campus, Jeff Nadeau. He is Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next time here on the sit down.